Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Surviving the Shift, a show where spirituality meets practicality, with your host, Michelle Arbeau.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Surviving the Shift. I'm your host, Michelle Arbeau. We're back on the air after a little bit of technical difficulty, so I hope all the listeners are still patiently waiting. So tonight's special guest is Felix Wolf. Now, Felix is an author, teacher, and transformational healer with academic degrees in cognitive psychology and oriental medicine. Felix has worked with the infamous Carlos Castaneda and he actually apprenticed with him for 3 years until the shaman's death in 1998. He served as his translator and was also featured in a documentary about Castaneda, The Enigma of a Sorcerer, which was shown at a variety of film festivals and theaters domestically and abroad. Wolf is also an avid lucid dreamer and visionary, intrigued with the prospect of collective awakening. He has lectured internationally to a variety of audiences about holistic medicine, awareness, and the art of navigation. So I'm interested to see what Felix has to say about this art of navigation and also about Carlos Castaneda, because there's quite a controversy surrounding his story indeed. I did a bit of research today, so let's bring Felix on and see what he has to say. Hello, Felix. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michelle. I'm happy it worked out finally.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I'm not sure what was going on. This is the third week in a row, and I think I solved the mystery, though. The technical support said that my browser may be kicking me out of the system. They told me to download a different browser, so I'm going to do that after the show, definitely, and hopefully this won't happen again. Yes. All right, so it's wonderful to have you here. You know, I was doing a bit of research on Carlos Castaneda today, and I thought, wow, this is quite an amazing story. And I posted it on Facebook, and there's been a lot of replies on this, so I think it's quite a hot topic, for sure. So I think maybe what we'll do, Felix, if you could maybe start us off with explaining your story surrounding your experiences with Carlos before we delve into the work that you're doing.
Well, it's kind of inseparable because, you know, what I felt I learned in all these years, I mean, actually I was involved with him over 20 years and just personally with apprenticing with him for a little over 3 years. And so the essence of the teachings and what transpired was the art of navigation. So for me, it is inseparably linked. And I also would see my coming in contact with him as a navigational event. So, but as far as the controversy goes, you know, I don't know, probably listeners who have an interest, they have different, you know, exposure to the phenomenon that was Carlos Castaneda. So maybe just let me throw in a few introductory remarks. So Castaneda was an anthropologist, first of all. He at the University of California, Los Angeles, and he studied the use of, actually for his dissertation, for his doctoral thesis, he went in the field to study the use of psychotropic hallucinogenic plants by the Native Americans of the Southwest, and he was looking for an informant, and he met like the mother of all informants, a Native American or Yaqui shaman he called Juan Matus. And so over the years, like in the beginning, he was just like noting down all what he could find out about the Native American practices. But over the years, he became an apprentice himself, and further down the road, he became a shaman, a full-fledged shaman with his own apprentices, and the knowledge system which actually he extracted from this apprenticeship with Juan Matus, with this Yaqui shaman, it had not much to do with what we generally associate with shamanism or sorcery or black magic or any and all of that. It was a knowledge system or belief system that had to do with the mastery of awareness above anything. And mastery of awareness meaning, you know, instead of just stumbling down the stairs of your life, kind of run by arbitrary thoughts in your mind. There is the idea to get a handle on what's going on in your mind, what's going on with your perception, and taking control or taking influence on that. So, I mean, this is sort of a bit of a background, and there were skills or how should I put this? There were certain practices that had to do with this mastery of awareness. One of it was the art of dreaming, which was taking control of your dreams in forms of dreaming lucidly, consciously, and bringing about out-of-body experiences. And another practice was called the art of stalking. That meant kind of, just basically what a good actor does, you know, taking on the role of someone else and kind of shifting your perspective and your identification with life in this way. And underlying all of this was the art of navigation, meaning rather than being run or governed by the mind, sort of being run or governed by a working relationship with the universe at large, or the spirit, or intent, as he called it. So I don't know, maybe I should stop here just for a second, if that's what you wanted to hear or wanted to go into.
Well, yes, that was a really good overview, because I think there's a lot of, misinformation out there as to what, you know, Carlos's teachings were, what his experiences were, and things like that. So that's definitely a good overview. But yeah, yeah. I mean, your book is based on navigation, so that's really...
Well, no, but actually, you know, I want to go into it a little bit more. You're right, because the controversy, I didn't touch on the controversy. I just gave a background of how Castaneda presented to me and to many people. So he wrote about, he wrote the 12 books altogether on his apprenticeship and on his on this knowledge system, and sold 10 million copies worldwide, translated into 17 languages. At the time, in the 1970s and into the 80s, he was very well known. That he was on the cover of Time magazine, and the Time magazine called him the godfather of the New Age movement. So he was for a generation of seekers or spiritual seekers, he was definitely a guiding force. And in whatever abstract terms I presented that the mastery of awareness, that was his field of interest. The controversy resulted out of especially after his death, then people just started examining his persona, his personal life, more than anything, and they found things they didn't like let's say that he had sexual relationships with some of his apprentices and things like that, and that he may have changed names of informants, and you know, basically nothing really is very spectacular, just what any trickster or Native American shaman, what you would expect. But because his genuine apprentices, the people who worked with him, never came forward and never engaged in this discussion, so that all that was brought out was basically a very one-sided interpretation of predominantly his person, his personality. And there, I just want to throw this in real quick. The way to deal with this, if it works for everyone or not, I don't know, but the way to deal with this is that Castaneda was two entities, if you want so, like many spiritual teachers are. He was a person, just like everyone else, like you and me, and as this person, he was an anthropologist, and he was also an author. But then he was a shaman, and as a shaman, he was a conduit, a guide that helped people or guided people towards a different experience, an utterly and radically different experience of life and reality. And as this conduit, as this shaman, or as what we call, we refer to him as the Nawal, he was peerless. He was indescribable and powerful and beneficial beyond description. As a person, in real life, he was a person with his idiosyncrasies and with character expressions that some people may like and some people may not like.
Yes, and from what I researched on him as well, you know, like you say, I think people were faulting him for being human or having an actual life, but mm-hmm. from what I read on him, you know, the teachings that he, I guess, stumbled upon or, you know, I guess, discovered, really do, I guess, they're very much based in a practical modality, you know, it really resonated with them. So I think that he was onto something for sure. I think that, you know, the teachings that he taught were very valid, you know, and people
well,
are judging him based on...
Yeah, I think he was born and onto something. He was utterly original and extremely powerful, and he brought into our awareness things that nobody else before him had put our attention on, and then a whole generation of people after him, including such famous names like Don Miguel Ruiz or even Dr. Wayne Dyer, actually took from where he what he presented and prepared and went further from there, just all on the body of work that Castaneda actually brought out. So he was definitely one of a kind.
Yes, you know, and I did see that when I was reading that. I was thinking, wow, you know, this is the basis of what modern-day spirituality is based on, all of the things that, you know, I had read about Carlos's teachings and the art of navigation, even in your book, you know, the teachings are definitely the basis of what we study today with all of the great gurus that are popular today.
Yeah, I think it definitely fits beautifully into like the perennial teachings of wisdom, you know, of personal transcendence. Like one of some of his core values or teachings were internal silence. You know, there it goes along with Buddhism or any other serious spiritual software or serious spiritual path. So and all, also the way it presented as a whole. Like when I was going at it more from the abstract side, you know, as in terms of mastery of awareness. But the way it presented in the beginning was just a warrior's path. You know, this is ancient, like the samurai philosophy of Japan, as a warrior's path, meaning just being impeccable and alert and authentic and you know, just sort of a path to coming into your own power. So it was nothing that was in any contradiction or in antagonistic to any other spiritual path.
Right. So how did you and Carlos meet? How did this come about?
Well, I met him actually in 1980, but I didn't know that it was him. There was just a very capricious or fortuitous encounter. But later I found out that it had been him, and then I've been kind of trying to find him ever since. And which was a very difficult endeavor because he was, he had come to quite a prominence, and he was very secretive. Nobody knew where he lived. Even when he was on the cover of Time magazine, they couldn't even find a photograph of him and could certainly not find out where he lived. So it was not an easy, you know, like a straightforward intellectual task to just look him up in a phone book or anything. So I just followed my instincts, my intuition, and then... And then I just found him. Actually, I found his agent, and then his agent at some point called me and invited me to a meeting in Los Angeles. And so then, from then on, I saw him only once a week in the beginning, and then it got more frequent towards his death. And I felt privileged to sort of be initiated into his work and you know, mastery of awareness.
Right. So your book, The Art of Navigation, is based on your experiences and what you've learned from Carlos. So could you tell us a little bit about your book and what that's about?
Well, The Art of Navigation is this, you know, Castaneda was different things to different people because he was a conduit. He was just more like a catalyst. So other people might draw different aspects of his teachings from apprenticing with him or from crossing paths with him. For me, the essence of the teachings was always grounded in what I call the art of navigation. And maybe a quick attempt to define what I mean. Navigating life, like maybe the most concise way to approach this, navigating life is like living from the heart instead of living from the mind. What it means is instead of asking oneself questions like, what do I want to do with my life? How can I get the most out of life? I would ask myself a question, what does life want me to do? And how can I find out? This as a meaning that would result in a life that is very different. Rather than you know, approaching life with thoughts and analytical, with reason, with memory, and, you know, it's just mental constructs. You approach life more like a treasure hunt, playful and open, like an inquiry of sorts, trying to find out what life itself has to communicate, and things we all know, you know, like synchronicities. I understand that you are very, very fascinated by synchronicities, omen, hunches, intuition, signs, things we all know and appreciate, but very few people probably feel confident or courageous enough to base their entire life on this communication with the universe at large. So that's basically in a few concepts what the art of navigation describes.
Yes, and I really like in the beginning in the book, the introduction where you write the questions, what do I want to do with my life and how can I get the most out of it? Or the other way to look at it is, what does my life want me to do and how can I find out mm-hmm. what life wants me to do? Yeah, I thought that was really mm-hmm. neat to see the two different perspectives, because one is really, you know, living from an intellectual standpoint or from the ego or from the mind, and the other one is living through those synchronicities and beautiful coincidences and things that show up in our lives and going with the flow.
Yeah, one is based on the understanding that we are separate, that we are like separated entities, and the other one, the navigation one, is based on the understanding that we are not separate, that we are connected. And we are connected to something that maybe is hard to grasp, but something, the spirit, intent, the universe, universal spirit, consciousness, awareness at large, however you want to call it, but something that is intelligent, that is easy, from my perspective, it's easy to see that nature, that life is intelligent. And if people have had, you know, the experience of synchronicities or like unmistakable hunches, omens, or like powerful intuitions, they would probably agree that it's entirely possible to engage in a communication with life. And that, if that is so, then to use an analogy, it's a little bit like if I work only from the mind, it's like using my computer only from the hard disk, basically, only without being connected to the internet. You know, like for me, navigating is like going online. It's like going online, and the universe is the World Wide Web, and it's just infinitely more powerful, and it's just incomparably more richer and truer than just operating from this basis of being separate.
Right, and in your book, you describe the five elements of navigation. Can you go through those briefly?
Yeah, well, you know, I just want to say that it would be making a mistake to see like navigation as something, because that would kind of draw it into a mental thing. If we would approach it from a step, you know, five step and five rules kind of angle. So I just want to say this. Well, this said, there is, because most people, like I say, or like I find, they, while recognizing that some communication with life is possible, and while they have the odd synchronicity or intuition about things, but it's just not enough. It's just not often enough, and not doesn't feel reliable enough. And if that is the perception, then there is indeed something we can do about it to kind of supercharge our navigational experience. And there is a five elements. I would call it the five elements of inquiry, actually. There are five elements which if we inquire into each one of them sort of regularly or sequentially, that begins to supercharge our navigational experience. So the first one, and maybe it's easiest to explain them along a small analogy. Like, let's say we are sitting in our car and we want to drive from point A to B. We want to navigate from A to B somewhere, wherever. And we have a navigational system in the car. So the first thing we want to do, of course, is to program our destination into this navigation system. And this I call intent. Intent is basically our innermost programming, our deepest longing, our innermost convictions, our belief systems, because they are kind of broadcasting the destination where we are going, if we want it or not. So whatever we believe deep, deep inside, our deepest yearnings, longings, fears, they are broadcasting our destination, just like we're entering our destination into a navigation system in a car. So intent is the first one, and so we want to explore this. What is our intent? What are our beliefs? What is our innermost conviction? And sometimes we might find we have conflicting beliefs, conflicting convictions, and that would not get us very far. So, and this destination, it can be something, it can be simple. It can be just like part of navigating a new career or a relationship, or it can go further, like a destination we might define as happiness or freedom or transcendence or whatever. You know, it can be very concrete or it can be very abstract and far-reaching. But we got to be clear that what is deep inside, what we want. So this is very important, intent, setting our intent, inquiring into our intent. The second element of inquiry here is, I call enthusiasm, a passion. That's where the heart is. In the car, it would be, if we only program our destination into the system, we're not going anywhere. We have to start the car. We have to push the gas pedal. We have to get this thing in motion. We have to imply some energy into our intent, and this comes from the heart. This is enthusiasm, passion. We have to inquire what makes us passionate. Where is our heart? Is it in line with our intent? And what increases our enthusiasm? What increases our vibrational rate? This can be simple things like food or lifestyle, but also it definitely has to do with what we want, what our heart wants, where we get excited. The third element, in the car example, it would be, it takes usually a while to get from A to B. We might be in a traffic jam. And so we have to cultivate something we call perseverance, persistence, patience. We have to learn to cultivate and hold and maintain and nourish the intent and the enthusiasm, otherwise it burns out quickly and we're not getting to our destination. So there's also practices that do that. You know, I can't go into all detail right now, but just as a to hold this in mind. Perseverance, persistence, patience, that's the third element of navigation. And the fourth element I call impeccability. In the car example, it's like we got to do our best. We don't want to drive drunk. We don't want to run red lights, stop signs, things like that, because otherwise we never get to our destination. And in life, same thing. We want to give our best effort. We have to do everything with integrity, authenticity, truth, precision, impeccability. Otherwise, our navigation is capricious and doesn't lead anywhere useful. The fourth element I call presence. That goes without saying. Presence, awareness, alertness. Because if in a car, if we don't watch the screen and the environment, we cannot match it. Navigation is not possible in life. If we are not fully awake, alert, ears, eyes open, we would not see all these countless communications that they're always available for us. Life is coaching us, coaxing us, helping us, guiding us. If we are not aware, if we are lost in thought or in pursuit of something futile, we are not aware, we are not present. So these are the five elements of navigation.
Okay, yeah. You know, when I was reading through your book, I was thinking to myself that these elements are, you know, they're very similar to, well, parts of them, of the law of attraction, which would be the intent and putting the emotion behind it and really getting enthusiastic about things. But there's more to it than just the law of attraction. For example, the perseverance aspect. How would you go about doing that? Or how would you suggest to people that they maintain perseverance and persistence and patience with that? Because I think that's where people get lost at that point. They're good at setting their intent for the most part, and they're good at putting the enthusiasm or the passion behind it and getting excited about it. But then because it takes time sometimes to achieve our goals, you know, we get lost in that part of it.
Yeah, maybe I want to just go one step back real quick, because the law of attraction is a little bit tricky, because what most people, unfortunately, apply this to is just simple volition, wanting, and what it very often results in is just neediness and more neediness. I remember watching that movie, The Secret, and I'm still have in my head that little boy standing in front of a shopping window, staring at his bicycle, and the idea was you just stare long enough, you get your bicycle, and that has nothing to do with the auto navigation. That is just like neediness and wanting sort of squared, and I would not want to sign off on that. So the navigation is a bit different, and you don't want to kind of just cultivate your intent and even cultivate your enthusiasm. You want to just inquire. The whole navigational mood is one of inquiry and one of openness. You're not sitting there and trying to run the world by definition, because if you navigate, you in a way is a It is an act of surrender if you navigate the way I understand it, because you're handing your life, the guidance of your life, over to the universe at large. So you cannot sit at the same time and like stare at a bicycle and want it to materialize. So it's a bit more subtle than that. But this said, it is comparable in a way. You know, you want to get clear about your intentions, and you want to get clear about where your heart is. But how to... And in the same way, you want to look into the element of perseverance in so far as you want to see what is there that supports. It's not just about like stubborn, you know, perseverance, persistence against all odds. It's actually, again, different, because you want to look what is there already that supports you. You want to see, you know, because... It's not you doing anything. It's seeing where the universe kind of comes in. So you want to feel the support of the earth that nourishes you and holds you and maintains you. And you want to kind of align with, let's say, the earth energies that hold you. And what you can do if you want to cultivate this is, for example, there's certain movements, you know, certain Qigong exercises that kind of... that cultivate this balance, this rootedness, you know. It's about connecting with the energy of the earth that supports us all, more than cultivating a certain stubbornness and a persistence as it is usually used. You know, it can go into eating the right things, you know, like that, and getting the feeling of the already existing, sustaining and supporting and nourishing qualities that are out there and aligning with them, rather than trying to... You see, I mean, it's a little bit difficult. We always want to slip back into the mind and run our life, like, you know, from... You understand what I mean? It's very tricky. Because, but so I have to be a little bit insistent on that. This is not working this way. You got to kind of, every element of navigation has an element of surrender, an element of handing your fate, your life over. And so persistence is the same thing. So rather than forcing yourself into just hanging on there, like grinding your teeth and I'm exaggerating a little bit to move forward, you'd rather kind of settle back and relax into the
energy. Is that what you mean by this? Is holding the energy?
Yeah, holding the energy, or even further, it's allowing the energy that is there, holding you and supporting you, and feeling that support. That'll give you the kind of the persistence or perseverance, patience that'll get you wherever you need to go.
Right. Okay, so just so that I am clear on this. So basically what you're saying, it's more about surrender than, you know, being very, you know, mind-oriented with this and pushing ahead and all of this. So setting your intent would be being clear on what you want, and then enthusiasm would be about holding that feeling associated with what you want, and then the perseverance is more about holding that energy and trusting and knowing that it's coming and you don't have to push to get it. Is this what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, ideally I would even let go of the idea to come out with something out of this exploration of the five elements. Just dig around in your what You dig around in your intent, what drives you at your core. Just dig around and don't try to come out with something that you have to write on a paper. Just dig around with it. Just wash it up. And the same thing you do with your heart and see where your heart is. And the same thing is where you try to find out how you are actually supported and how you know, just kind of make this aware rather than extracting something that then you turn into a doing of sorts. I understand this is kind of difficult to grasp, but I unfortunately otherwise it becomes another doing. And navigating in the sense I learned it, it's not really a doing. It's an allowing more than anything.
Yes, and I think it's a very tricky fine line to walk.
Yes.
Because I think we all want to slip back into that
yes.
mindset where we have to push to get everything, right? And so,
yes,
yeah,
exactly.
I can see where you're coming from this, but I just, you know, it's hard for me to
I understand,
that line.
Yeah, no, I
yeah.
feel really bad about being so stubborn about it.
Oh, no, that's okay. You know what? You explaining this is really helping me understand it because I read it and I did grasp it, but it's just... I think it's something that we have to, I guess, let us sit on, you know, and let us, I guess, mull the idea over and get used to it. Because it's like an old pattern, really. We're breaking that old pattern of wanting to get into the mindset and push ahead, full steam ahead with life, right? And so this is more about allowing. And so it's about really getting into that pattern of not wanting to push.
Yeah, and I understand. I mean, if you read my book, I'm not really kind of presenting it in a book as I do right now, because the book is sort of is presented in stories and the way I came into this navigational experience. And of course, in the beginning, it looked different than it looks now. Like it's a little bit like dancing, you know, like learning a complex dance. So in the beginning, you don't even need the music in the beginning. You practice the dance step, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and you practice and practice. And then you add the music to it, and then you are very focused on aligning with the music, and then you still may move awkwardly. But if you go down the line, if you do this over and over and again, then, you know, there is not even a dance anymore. There's just a dancing event. If you see the visual, you know, of like a dancer who's been dancing all his life, you just... You know, it's just one event, music, dancer, everything is one, and you forget about the beginning steps. So even these navigational elements, while they're fairly sophisticated because they are meant as an inquiry and an allowing and just an exploration rather than like the 5 steps or 12 steps to something, but still it's sort of... to get into it, it's like a shoehorn, you know, to get into the experience, which is intuition, you know, once you navigate, how should I say, optimally, there's no more steps and no more elements. It's just a dance. You know, you don't think and always you stop in your tracks and, oh, what does that mean? What does this sign mean? What does this mean? This is not really how you're experiencing it. But you've got to kind of find in, so you use that shoehorn on these 5 elements and anything else you can. But a whole mood is always one of openness, an inquiry, and of allowing, and of surrender, ultimately.
Yes, and like I say, it's, you know, it's something to really wrap your head around. And again, I'm using my head as an example, but really, I mean, like you say, it's hard to get into that mindset or into that groove, I guess you could say. Yeah, I like that analogy that you used about dancing, because most people are focused on learning the dance steps when really what you want to be doing is just dancing to the music. And not worried
about
it. Yeah,
but you have to learn the dance steps. My wife is a flamenco dancer, and when we met, I wanted to learn flamenco too, and boy, I mean, is that difficult? You know, you have to move every limb, all 4 limbs, to a different rhythm. You know, there's just so there is no music feels even disturbing. You know, you're just trying to coordinate and learn that. So it has nothing to do with dancing. In the beginning, it's like a workout, like gymnastics, and navigation can be the same. You know, and I often when I do interviews or people call in and ask and. It's like, oh, I had this and this experience. What does it mean? That's kind of that's like what happens in the beginning a lot, you know, like you have like this big rainbow, whatever, and happening at this and this moment. And it's like, oh, what does it mean? What does it mean? What does it mean? But this is not really I mean, while it's it's hard to avoid, you know. You have a big, you haven't met someone for ages, and then you meet the same person like four times a day, and then of course you think, wow, it must mean something. But the moment you ask this question, in a way, you kind of step out of the flow, you know. You stop, and then you engage the mind, and while it's understandable, but it's not the best way of going about it. It's just like you just develop trust, and you develop the trust that whatever it means, or whatever it's going to guide you, or you know, divert you, or lead you, it's going to become obvious by itself. It's an increasing process of surrender and allowing and dancing.
Yes. You know, I'm guilty of that myself. You know, things will show up and I'll question it to death as to why this is happening, or why I'm seeing this number sequence so much, or this mm-hmm. person keeps calling me, or this, you know, this person keeps popping up everywhere, and I analyze it to death. So, like you say, it's going to happen whether I analyze it to death or not, so just let it be and let it go and allow it to happen.
Well, I understand that. I understand that, you know, that is the natural response, and I'm not trying to condemn it. It's okay to let this natural response be there. But I just wanted to throw this in and just kind of de-emphasize it, you know, because I've seen just people being completely paralyzed by what does it mean, you know, and then while they're standing there scratching their head, a whole row of other guidance, signals, omens, hunches, whatever, synchronicities are happening, and we don't see them because we are in freeze mode over that one.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. So what about the impeccability area that you were talking about, doing your best? Well, could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, not that it really needs explaining, but I will try my best. You know, the thing is, and actually that brings me to a point that pertains to all five elements, because all of them, all by themselves, it's not that you have to kind of memorize and all the five elements, you have to kind of always do all the five elements. It's every single one of those elements is like a doorway, a gateway. You could just kind of awaken to yourself, to your true self, or self-realized, or just by completely allowing yourself to be absorbed in one of the elements, you know, just by diving into intent, the intricacies, the mystery of intent, you could just pop out self-realizing and, you know, awakening to your true self, and then the whole navigational experience becomes your default mode of operation. There's no more questions. And impeccability, maybe most of all, but impeccability, it's just a term that Castaneda kind of brought into my life. I think I understand that usually it's more used in a religious connotation. But what it means, and there's some related terms that I would put into the same category, like integrity, authenticity, truth, precision. Impeccability is, you know, in an example, we used to, my wife and I are acupuncture physicians, and we used to work with troubled teenagers, which actually brought me into writing this book, because they were so fascinated with the art of navigation that kept asking me if there's something written about it, and so I eventually sat down and wrote this book. So, and one thing that was on their mind was like what to do after high school, you know, which college or whatever. So maybe you have like three colleges in mind, and you write your applications. And one application you write, like, you know, with your best effort, sober, and you put your best self into it. And the other, you've been partying all night, and you just kind of, like, do it like sort of like a chore and half-baked. And the third one, you know, in another mood and incomplete. And then if you put it out like this, then it comes back that you are accepted by this one college, or let's say you're not accepted by any of the colleges, and then you think, well, my navigation, you know, guides me into not going to college or something. That's just not working like this, you know. You would have to do your impeccable best, like write three impeccable applications, meaning do your best, whatever that may be at any given time. Only then can you be reasonably confident that whatever happens, like say you're not accepted by any of these colleges, that this is indeed your natural flow and not just something you brought on yourself. So this is would be an example for impeccability and navigation.
Okay, that makes much more sense. Yes, that example was perfect. Now I understand what you meant by impeccability for sure. The other thing I wanted to know about was the fact that you are an avid lucid dreamer. Now, how do dreams factor into this whole art of allowing and just, you know, allowing things to flow? Where do dreams come into play with that?
Well, yeah, that's kind of a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, it's not a necessary precondition, you know. It just happened to be a predilection I had, and it was a part of Castaneda's knowledge system that he coached us in becoming conscious in our dreams. It plays into the art of navigation in several ways. I mean, first of all, maybe I should explain, like, lucid dreaming, maybe not everybody's familiar with it. So I'm not talking about just regular dreaming, like what everybody dreams at night, and then maybe we remember that dream or we don't remember that dream. Lucid dreaming means that we are conscious when we are dreaming, or that we are becoming aware while we are dreaming that we are dreaming. So sometimes people tell me, yes, I think I was consciously dreaming once. So this is not possible. If you are consciously dreaming, if you are lucid dreaming, you know for sure, because you are completely alert and completely awake in that dream, meaning you are dreaming, you know that you're dreaming, and you know at the same time that you're actually laying in bed and you're probably completely aware on which side are you laying and everything else. So this is a very, very lucid state. You are completely aware, just like in your waking time, but you are in a dream reality. That's just lucid dreaming. And there is a variation thereof, which basically has only to do with the kind of the entry event. Because while lucid dreaming, you could just say anywhere in your dream, you could just suddenly become lucid because something really outlandish happened in your dream and you were just startled. But then there is what we call an out-of-body experience. This is marked by the experience, as the name says, that you feel that your awareness is actually outside of your body. Your dreaming awareness, your dreaming body is actually outside your body. I mean, you may find yourself standing next to your body. But then you do something, you know, either you engage in a dream activity or you fly away or you do something. And from then on, it's not any different than any other lucid dream. So what is this good for? I mean, for once, it's immensely entertaining, because obviously if you're conscious in your dream, you can dream whatever you want. So you can fly where you can visit whoever you want to visit. You can engage in any kind of indulgences you can think of or dream up. So it is immensely entertaining. We kind of try to get our troubled teenagers into this because it's at least as entertaining and much less harmful, or not harmful at all, than taking drugs, what they usually had problems with. But what I find the most useful aspect of lucid dreaming is that it serves as a blueprint for our waking time, because it is my experience that just in the same way as we can become conscious that we are dreaming during our sleeping hours, in the very same way we can become conscious that this life, which we think to be so factual and so unmistakably real, is actually just has exactly the same parameters as a dream as well. So that's what's called awakening. In real life, in waking life, this kind of event is called awakening or enlightenment. If we recognize that we are actually normally sort of in a dream bubble of thoughts in our waking reality. And so by having like repeated lucid dreaming experiences, we can transfer this event to our waking time, and I think it might facilitate awakening to our real self, to our true self. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, actually. I've done a little research on lucid dreaming, and I think you mentioned a little bit about astral traveling, which is when you're outside of your your body and kind of, you know, flying around in the wherever you're flying to. I remember as a child I used to do that a lot, and leave my body and be flying around my neighborhood, things like that. And it was later that I found out that this was astral traveling. Is it not?
Yeah, it is astral traveling. Out of body experience and astral travel is synonymous. What I was just saying, and this is kind of hard to prove, we have a good friend of ours, Dr. Stephen LaBerge. He's been studying lucid dreaming at Stanford University for 30 years, and I've been discussing this with him a lot, and he feels that it is the same, because what he observes happening in the brain, the same things happen if you do astral travel and if you do lucid dreaming. And he just feels that the entry is different, you know, because once you are conscious in your normal dream, you can also fly around. And then I really would have to say it's impossible to differentiate from, like, if you just get out of your body and then you fly around, or if you just become lucid and you fly around, it's the same flying around in a dream universe, you know. So it depends. My predilection is on astral travel, so I'm out of body experience person. I have very rarely I had just a regular lucid dreams. I usually always go out of body, but I do not know how to differentiate. And also, in terms of, you know, the purpose or the benefit of it is the same. Just recognizing the illusory reality that of our daytime world.
Yes. So how do we go about doing the lucid dreaming actively or consciously, I guess, because, you know, we've all probably had experiences, whether we remember them or not, of doing, you know, the lucid dreaming or the astral travel, but how do we do that?
It's quite simple, actually. You know, there's lots of techniques, and rather than doing like five techniques simultaneously, it's probably enough just doing one. Like, I mean, there's also lots of books on that, you know, whatever I cannot cover in a few minutes. There's lots of books, dozens of books that deal with that, you know, from books with simple titles like Lucid Dreaming or Astral Travel in 30 Days to more complex, more scientific books. So one thing is definitely to read lots of books on that, to just immerse your mind in that. That'll already prepare you for having lucid dreams. Then the other thing is there's certain things that that do not work in lucid dream or in dreams. For example, cell phones do not work. So I can tell you right now, whenever you find that your cell phone just doesn't work, you can't punch in that number you want, you can't find that friend, you're most likely dreaming. And maybe you remember, and that's all it takes. You remember that you're dreaming, you become aware, and then you go from there. And to kind of maintain your lucid state, that's another art, but I recommend to read books on that, because that would take too long. Another thing is a good induction method is to read things during the course of the day. Everything you come across, every, you know, street sign or bulletin board or whatever you can read, or somebody's writing on a T-shirt, you read it, you look away, you read it again, and you look away again, and you read it a third time. It has been shown in lab, in university research, in sleep labs, that in dreams, if you read something a second time, there's about 65% chance it does not say the same thing. And the third time is like 95-98% that it's going to say something else.
Wow.
You understand what I mean? Say you over a door, you read the sign exit, and then you look away, and you look at it again. In the daytime, you can do that 10 times, and you always say exit. But in a dream, if you would do the same thing, you look at it, and you maybe say extra, or you may say something, whatever, extraterrestrial, or whatever, you may say something entirely different already the second time. So this is something to... I remember my wife, she was not so much into lucid dreaming, and we went to a seminar with Dr. LaBerge, and it took her 2 days of kind of compulsively reading everything three times. She came across, and then she woke up she became conscious in a dream, because in this dream she was writing down something, and she read it again, and it was saying something else, and then she was aware, and then she decided to fly. That's a good idea to have something, because often when we become conscious in our dream, we are so excited that we wake ourselves up and then we are bummed out. So
yes.
it's a good idea to have a plan. Like, my recommendation is that if you become conscious, don't think much, don't get too excited, just go fly, do something. And flying is something everybody likes.
Yes, yeah, I remember that as a child. That was quite interesting, for sure. I haven't done that in a very long time, but I definitely, I'll definitely pick up a book on that because it sounds very fascinating and sounds a lot like what I used to do. So I guess I'm capable of it. I just need to get back into it, for sure.
By all means. There's something else real quick I want to say. If you are, oh, no, I lost it. I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. Was it about dreaming? You were mentioning something else about the dreaming. Is that?
Yeah, about dreaming, but I just completely lost the train of thought.
Okay. All right. That's all right. And the other thing I guess we didn't cover was the fact that you also do oriental medicine and holistic. What about that? What do you do in that area?
Well, I just I learned acupuncture, you know, as a trade. I'm a doctor of oriental medicine, and so is my wife, and it's just our regular profession. It felt natural to study. I mean, I also have a degree in psychology, but I was not inclined once I was not inclined to pursue that. It didn't feel intuitive. I like that energetic approach of energy healing modalities like acupuncture, because that's also what I became acquainted with through my work with Castaneda, just to see the world and the human body more energetically. There's an energetic entity, you know, where energy flows and has a certain balance. And that's what you work with. This is the paradigm you work with in Oriental medicine. So we just do acupuncture, and we've been doing it in many different forms. And we used to introduce acupuncture on cruise ships. We are in cooperation with Celebrity Cruises, and then we worked with troubled teenagers at a boarding in the U.S. In nation's largest boarding school in Montana. I mean, for troubled teens. And right now, I'm not working too much. I mean, I have a few clients, and I'm usually engaged is more transformational acupuncture. I mean, I'm trying to facilitate higher awareness states through the means of oriental medicine.
Right. Okay. Well, that's, you know, that's the work that you've done prior to this. So now you're really, I guess, immersed in the book that you're doing. And you're also writing a workbook that goes along with this, are you not?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because like I said, the book I have been, the one you've been reading, it is more an introduction. It was a way, I was just weaving the art of navigation into the stories as they came into my life, and I find this is kind of an easy way to absorb it with practical examples. And right now I'm working on a workbook about the five elements of navigation, sort of going in depth and along the lines that we are discussing right now.
Yes, I think that's much needed, yes. I think that will really help people to understand what it means. It's really great that you've gone about this as a storytelling, you know, kind of book, and it's great to hear that background. But I think the workbook will be the kind of, you know, the icing on the cake, so to speak, that people will really be able to get into this and understand it from your level or your perspective.
Yeah, it allows me to go much deeper, you know. But I think also the stories allow you to ease into the, because it is ultimately quite a different way of life, you know. If you live life as a dance and a treasure hunt and playfully, it's not what most people life experiences. And so I felt that the stories was a good way of presenting that. But now, you know, going in depth, there's many aspects of the art of navigation that deserve more attention. Like what I'm particularly passionate about is that it is a way of life that lends itself to basically every approach in life. You know, if you, like I said, if you're just navigating a career change or finding a partner or spouse, or if you're aiming for total transcendence and ultimate freedom, you can navigate just the same. It's just a matter of a sliding scale of sorts. You know, it's not that the inbuilt intent or the default intent of navigation is transcendence in a way. It is total freedom, because if you hand your life over, the guidance of your life over to life itself, then you end up living the life of life itself, and that is basically you kind of disappear as a separate entity, as a person. So this is the default intent, but you don't, if you're not, if that's not your fate, you're not your destiny, then you don't have to follow it all the way, you know. You just use it like you would treasure hunt, just for having more fun, more magic, more adventure in life.
It sounds so wonderfully easy, yet incredibly difficult at the same time to grasp. But yeah, you've done a great job of explaining, you know, the aspects of it. You know, you really helped me to get it, because I like I say, I've been reading the book, but there's a fine line there. So I think you did a really great job of explaining it, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I find from studying your work that we are not that far apart. You know, apparently you are working a lot with synchronicities and using numbers to guide yourself, and I've been doing this a lot myself. Numbers are perfect, you know, because they're everywhere, and we have everybody has certain affinity to special numbers or sets of numbers. So this is a very good way to get into it. You know, I've been doing this a lot, as you might have found in my book also. Like, my favorite number is 4, and so, you know, if it is 4:44 and the phone rings and I give a different attention to the call than if it rings at an arbitrary time or things like that, you know, it's just very, very, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're right by saying that the more you, I guess, sit back and allow, the more synchronicity and the more things show up, and it's a continual cycle, so it's you know, you're rewarded for not pushing and not doing those things. But yeah, the number 4 actually is the most basic of all numbers. So I think that you are really resonating with the 4, because that represents allowing and just being, because 4 is the most primary or the most basic of all the numbers. It's kind of like the foundation number. It's very much the foundation of life, so to speak.
Yeah, I know it as a number of stability, you know, like in the tarot or like in some certain number systems. And, well, it's just I'm born on the 4th and I'm married on the 4th, and actually 2 times. So it just happens to be always coming up, you know, and I'm enjoying this. You know, maybe one last thing just to say about navigation, it doesn't always have to do with like making decisions. I don't just navigate if I have to make a decision or move somewhere else or change my job. It's just fun to just dance with life, like, you know, just the feeling that you're the right place at the right time. You know, it doesn't always have to mean anything, you know, if all these synchronicities just falling in on you. And it's just fun, you know. It just sometimes makes me laugh out loud and gives me goosebumps. And just feeling in this dance, not being alone, not separated, that is a very, very important part of navigation.
Yes. You've definitely given us food for thought, for sure, and I'm going to be definitely reading the rest of the book, and I can't wait to read the workbook as well. So if someone would like to get your book, Felix, the website is theartofnavigation.com. Is that right?
Yeah, it's right, and there's also a lot of information on the website also, the 5 elements. There's quite a lot of little things packed in, so if someone wants to kind of get a bit of an overview, the website would be an excellent place to go. And there's also links to Amazon.com Barnes & Nobles and other bookstores that carry the book.
Great, great. Thank you so much, Felix, for coming on the show. We have about 2 minutes left, so I'd like to thank you so much. And definitely we'll have to have you on again when you have your workbook out and find out what that's all about.
Thank you, Michelle. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, great. Next show, we have special guest Filippo Francini. Filippo is a world-renowned musician who is a pioneer in bringing Nada Yoga to the West. He's been called the Ram Dass of meditative music. Filippo is one-third yogi, one-third rock star, and one-third Pied Piper, and an entertainer whom audiences love to follow as he creates an atmosphere of Om Sweet Om wherever he goes. So it's going to be an interesting show next week. He's going to be coming on to let us know all about his new album, Magic and Grace. So join us next week for another great episode of Surviving the Shift.